Welcome to another news. I'm Jeff Brady. Today we take a look into the collections of coins, stamps, and artifacts amassed by Harry Hubbard. We've talked with Harry about his ancient map collections and the artifacts in the southern central Illinois cave known to be the tomb of Alexander the Great and Cleopatra. In a 1997 presentation titled The Dead Sea Scroll Mystery, Who Stole the Lamp Past the Hat?, Harry Hubbard and his colleague Paul Shafranchi analyze ancient coins, currency, postage, and much more, including the Dead Sea Scrolls. The presentation raises important questions, not only about the source of paper currency in the mid-19th century, but of the authenticity of the Dead Sea Scrolls. Harry Hubbard joins us again to cover some of the content in this presentation. Harry, welcome back to Another News.
Thank you, Jeff. Thank you.
Well, we're going to look into this video titled The Dead Sea Scroll Mystery, Who Stole the Lamp and Passed the Hat? And you go through your collections of currency, stamps, and coins, among other references. But let's start with the oil lamps, because I think it gives listeners a good idea of the ancient artifact racket.
Well, the first part is called Who Stole the Lamp? And it's actually my ridiculous take on the alleged ancient authentic oil lamps that have been for sale for the past 30, 40 years, maybe even before then, of the clay lamps that are all in really good shape that you can buy on the internet through catalogs. I can't remember. I don't know if I first noticed them in catalogs or at some of the ancient coin shows, but ancient coin shows, a lot of people sell artifacts too. And I was able to examine several hundreds of these oil lamps. And they'd have a little bit of dirt or mud caked up on them, but none of them ever appeared to be used. And they were all, like, in pristine condition. And, of course, they find them in hoards like they do ancient coins. So it was just my hilarious take on Who Stole the Lamp, because my deduction was that someone had to go steal everybody's lamp and put them in a hole and bury them, cover it up with dirt. So, you know, it was just a ridiculous take, which I do from time to time in some of my presentations, just throw something out there that's just absolutely ridiculous. But, hey, it is logical in the end. So, you know.
It's a good example of, if you're buying ancient artifacts, of some of the scams that could exist within that market, within that business, and you being very close to it as a collector, I thought it was really interesting.
I had some books from the late 80s, early 90s, mid-90s, and the prices seemed to just keep going up and up. The lamps were constantly changing. The quality of these oil lamps was increasing, and well, they just were in pristine condition, just thousands and thousands of them. And now today, I'm working on a sequel to that first part of the video, mm-hmm. And in my sequel, the first part of it is called The Lamp Still Burns. And I just touched briefly on the lamps because that's not the main gist of the presentation. But now you can buy those lamps by the box. Boxes of them.
Implying that they're not really rare anymore, and it very possibly some organization is just making them and saying that they're ancient.
Hey, you said it, not me. You said it. Yep. But when you buy them by the box, you get a better deal. You get a discounted price. And sometimes free shipping. I know you're in awe. You're like, wow, it really has evolved, hasn't it? Yes, it has. Yeah, they seem to get better at it. But as people get more interested in ancient history, there is an enthusiastic desire there to have a piece of history, to own some type of ancient history. And it's an easy show-go. Someone comes over and says, hey, where did you get that? Hey, man, I bought it for just $250. And they're, it's not uncommon at all anymore to see them for $250, $300, $400. Those lamps back in the early 90s were $20, $35, $40, $45. So you go figure.
You dig into the currency collection in this presentation and show people what the first U.S. United Colony currency looks like. That was backed by the Southern Confederacy, as you mentioned, and the federal banks at the time were catching up and issuing the first dollar bill. Can you tell listeners what you noticed during that time in the 1860s when a federal currency was printed into circulation?
Well, I had two paragraphs. The most predominant thing, they were much larger than the bills we have today. And the there was like two paragraphs of print on the back of them. Hello?
Yes, right here.
Well, I don't know what that was. Okay, I heard a click. Beep, 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 beep. So anyway, let's... Jeff, one of the things I noticed was that as the 1860s came about, the early 1860s, I believe it was actually 1861 after the Civil War began, that federal paper notes came on the scene with all the print on the back of them and such. About that time, the same type of paper money just flourished across the planet all at once. In a span of just like 10, 15 years, with the same type of denominations of like 1, 5, 10, 20, 50, 100. And it didn't really matter what the value of the currency was or what nation it was. There would be like some person's head on the front, maybe some scripting on the back, some other scripting all around it, an ancient building or a government building of major significance printed on the back, just different things like that. The colors were relatively droll. They weren't bold and bright like they became in the 20th century. Paper money started really getting colored up, especially Russian money at the time of Lenin. A beautiful paper currency came out of Russia. But it was Russian money, but it appeared to me that they were all printed in Pennsylvania.
Philadelphia. I got you. Okay, and that's interesting. England had a printing press, Germany had a printing presses, and Philadelphia and probably Washington, D.C. or New York had printing presses. And is that because there was a lack of printing presses to print currency? Why do you think that there was a limited source printing currency around the world?
Because, well, the printing presses were actually made in Germany, as I understood, and I actually found in a book, which means also German currency and Swiss currency was most likely printed in those countries. And most likely also Germany or Switzerland was printing Polish, Czechoslovakian, Yugoslavian paper monies, you know, they or some, but it looks like it was just all interrelated. It was all interrelated. The presses, the specific process of tooling the dies and using those dies to stamp out paper money. Now, I have had dozens and dozens of coin books, dozens and dozens of books on paper money, and you can find a book pretty much printed about any subject, any procedure, anything you ever, ever wanted to know. Nowadays, you can Google it. The modern researcher has nothing more than Googling. And you can find out so many things. But Google how to make paper money, and boom, zip, you got nothing. There are no books printed on how to make paper money. Now, you have counterfeiters out there that can take a bill and do different things with it, and you have master counter. I think the Chinese now have a $100 bill that's, they call it the super bill, that you cannot tell the difference. And they've injected them into our market, and I think that they actually did that like 8-9 years ago. But to go online or to find a book or to be able to buy a book on actually how to manufacture paper money, or even mint coins, for that matter. To stamp out a quarter, it ain't going to happen. You're not going to find the procedures of how that is done.
Getting back to the printing presses in Philadelphia, for example, you mentioned they were printing currency for countries all over the world, such as Iraq and even Tibet. That's the first time I've heard of this, Terry.
Well, the Philadelphia is also where everybody's stamps were printed as well. They had the presses, they had the dyes, they just stamped them out for everybody. All of South America, Europe, Asia, everywhere. You know, it's not like, and the stamps came about at the same time. You know, right there with the currencies. The stamps just happened, boom. And within 10 years, just about every country, large, small, minuscule, anywhere around the planet, all of a sudden had stamps. And they were all, had stick them on the back that you lick. They all had little perforations. And the, I guess the entire industry of mail delivery just, boom, happened everywhere across the planet at the same time. Isn't that peculiar?
It is. And now, why is this unusual?
Well, like I say in the video, is that there were many countries that were just, I mean, several. It wasn't just one or two. It was several countries, little tiny countries in the 1800s and early 1900s that don't even exist anymore. They've been swallowed up by larger countries. Different kingdoms have passed hands, and one emperor dies, and then another one takes over, and somebody gets him. But they had all these stamps for countries where everyone in the country was absolutely 100% illiterate. So my question was, is who was writing letters to who? Why do they need a catalog of like 20 or 30 stamps for a country that has 100% illiteracy? And it said so right there in the stamp collector. Look, this country is totally illiterate. But yet they got all these stamps. I mean, entire pages in these old stamp books that I had. I bet you can't even get some of those old stamp books anymore.
Do you know the answer to why they would issue stamps in a particular country like that? Why would they come from the United States?
Well, it might have been an effort to promote literacy. In other words, you say to Aunt Bessie that, well, if you could learn how to read and write, you can write your niece over here a letter and put it in an envelope and put a stamp on it and drop it into the store downstairs, and it will eventually get to her. Postage actually established an industry.
So we're talking about postage, money orders, currency. How did it become apparent to you that it was the same entity or organization printing up all of it?
Well, because they all had the same style, the same colors of ink. They all had the same type of people's heads. The heads just changed. And they all had the same number of perforations down the sides. It wasn't like that all this was accident. They were all stuck together on a big sheet. The sheets that the stamps were actually produced on were all the same size.
There was uniformity.
Yes. Around the planet, around everywhere. I know you're thinking, like, how in the world does that happen? Yeah, you got me. You got me, brother. I don't know. I'm just pointing out some peculiarities.
What year would you say this is happening in?
Oh, after the 1860s, comes about 1880s, 1890s, up into the 20th century. Right after World War II and after World War I. It was pretty obvious. But you had to have a lot of material in front of you to examine it and be looking for it. I approached it not from a stamp collector's view of like, hey, I got this stamp. Where does it go in the book? I looked at the overall picture of everything, laying them all out on big tables, looking at them, because I had so many stamps from my father, my uncle, my grandfather. They had stamps that they had gotten from their father, so it was like, wow, I've got a plethora of stuff here. Wasn't worth a whole lot, because stamps aren't really worth very much anymore. There's not that many people that collect stamps, and naturally, because now stamps are just quirky, you stick them, you can't collect them like you used to. Any stamp collector is probably going to mostly collect stamps from, 50, 60 years ago.
A listener tuning in right now may say, well, listen, you guys, it's obvious that there's limited numbers of printing presses in the world. It makes sense that they would only come from a certain source if they were printing money for various countries and other states around the world, it makes sense that they will be coming from places like Germany, Philadelphia, London, maybe New York.
Well, there's more to it than what is on the bill. It is the paper compound itself that was the dead giveaway. These currencies aren't just pieces of paper like notebook paper, that what you wad it up and then it just stays crinkled up and you can't. A dollar bill, you can wad it up, roll it around in your hand, and then flatten it back out, and it's not torn.
In one of your analyses in the presentation of the currency, you suggest that an organization has been controlling the money for 2,500 years.
Pretty much. It definitely comes in after, like, the 1700s. And then I really don't know why they didn't have paper money back in the 1700s. I don't understand that. Well, they did with the Spanish currency, the continental notes that they had here that was based on the Spanish shilling. The continental notes, continental Congress notes that were first in the United States, the problem was that they were so easy to forge. And so the paper money just basically became worthless. And I have seen what has been claimed to be a forgery, and I have seen what has been claimed to be for real, and I can't tell any difference between the paper, the print, magnifying glass. I don't know why somebody says this is one and this is the other. They look so much alike. But I wasn't an expert. I was just a novice interested in getting down to the bottom, the core, and became quite proficient in seeing this, seeing that, and then just asking the wrong questions.
Harry, as a coin collector buying and trading ancient coins, you ask the question, what are the chances of having so many ancient coins, suggesting that if these coins are real, something extraordinary would have had to happen for them to exist? Can you talk about that?
Can I talk about that? For hours, days, weeks. You know, funny thing, Jeff, is that nowadays, and even from the early 90s, of where I'm going back to with my new video, the Ancient Coin Vault, there is a problem with moving ancient coins. Okay, they find ancient coins in what they call hoards. Now, a hoard can be 10 coins, it can be 1,000 coins, can be 1,500, 1,600, can be 2,000 coins. They find them all in one place, in one area, all buried together in dirt, and they're either in pristine condition or not. Who knows? But my issue is, how did they move those coins? Did the guy have a burlap bag and just put all the coins in there? Did he have a camel skin bag? Well, how's he going to carry 40, 50, 60 pounds of coins And like from one place to another? It's like these wealthy Romans, if they had so many coins that the donkey couldn't move them, well, how did they do it? How did they do it? Are you going to put 100 pounds of ancient coins on a donkey and then move from town to town? Well, what about all the robbers and thieves and pirates along the way, and the bandits? Well, what do you do? I figured out how they move their coins, their ancient coins. Hundreds, thousands of them, you know, that are going to weigh a lot of weight. What kind of bag can you sew together that can hold 100 pounds of metal?
Mm-hmm.
And I figured out what they did. They just called up Brinks. Brinks would come in, pick up the coins, and move them for them. That's how ridiculous I can be with figuring out how these people did some of the things they did. Now, of course, that's not what happened.
Mm-hmm.
That's just absolutely hilarious and flabbergasting, okay? But the thing is how does an ancient coin collector or an ancient coin dealer explain to me how did that hoard get there? For instance, they found underneath a Roman bridge, the Trier collection. They found thousands of coins, or hundreds and hundreds, like 1,500, 1,600, 1,800 coins, I can't remember exactly, buried underneath an old Roman bridge in Tyre, Germany. Okay, well, how did they get there? Did four or five priests just, great, man, let's bury them here. Let's bury them. We got, you know, man, this bag is so heavy, I can barely walk. Well, how many ancient coins can a horse carry? You know, and even in the old caravans of Egypt, how many bars of gold can a camel carry? I don't know what the payload of a camel is. I'm not sure what the payload of a horse is or a donkey. But, my gosh, I know what the payload of a human is. How did they get them down there? How did they do it? Was it burlap bags? Was it pig skins sewn together? You're carrying something, tiny pieces of metal that is heavy. It's either copper or bronze, silver. Well, not just, it's either bronze, silver, or gold. Mm-hmm. And when you've got them all in a bag, and they're all banging up against each other and rubbing up against each other, how is it that they all end up in mint condition?
Yes.
Extra, extra fine.
I thought that was a really interesting reveal that you did in the presentation, again, connecting back to the ancient artifact scam that you've exposed.
Well, if we're going to go back there, let me point this out to Jeff, for your audience. It's not only the oil lamps or the coins. It's all these little Egyptian statues. It is the makeup pieces. It is the rings, the brooches, the hair pieces. See, we were at one. My colleague and Paul and I were at some ancient coin show somewhere in Florida, and there was a bronze ring for sale there, and I saw it, and it looked big enough for his finger. I said, Paul, try this ring on. So he tried it on, and it fit him. It fit him just fine. And I said, okay, I want to buy that ring for my colleague there. Okay, so Paul had a bronze ring. He said, wow, you know, cool. It was like $30-$35. Wasn't much. Anyway, I just wanted to buy him something because he didn't want to go. He never wanted to go to the ancient coin, but he would take it. But once I got him there, he was at home. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So I had him on a bronze ring. And he wore that ring. It's summer all the time in Florida. It's hot. He wore that ring for a couple of weeks. Sweat, hot, everything. Well, funny thing. The ring started to disintegrate, and it left a black, heavy black, greenish black marking all around his finger. Well, no one in ancient times would wear a ring that would just absolutely discolor their finger. It was horrible. So I'm like, well, you know, there's no way that could be real. There's no way that particular alloy could have ever been used as a decorative piece of jewelry because it turns your hand black. I mean, the whole bottom of his finger was black, dark brownish, blackish, greenish.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure this, you know, people listening will agree if they've had similar experiences. But in the section of this video, past the hat, in assessing ancient Roman coins, you and Paul noticed something peculiar. There's often the head of an emperor engraved on the coin, but they're wearing a spiked hat. I'm not sure if this has to deal with fraud or what's going on here, but could you tell listeners what you found out regarding this anomaly?
Well, the hat does not exist. What they call the radiant does not exist anywhere except on coins.
Mm-hmm.
And the hat has a span. The hat, the spiked hat, which is called the radiant, its heyday was in the late 200s A.D., 240 to like 280, 290 or so. Every Roman emperor had himself pictured in a radiant,
mm-hmm.
which they were different, but none of them ever existed. So how did all these mentors or these coin dye manufacturers and all of the Roman mints, how did they know? How did they know to put 5 spikes on the hat or 6 spikes on the hat? How would they have ever known?
Is this an indication in your mind as something fraudulent in terms of manufacturing ancient artifacts, or is this something having to deal with maybe a secret order or something like that.
Well, you just used the F word. I don't use the F word. I can say that I have cleaned up my act. I do not use that word that you just used, and I don't use the other F word, which is fake. I don't use those two F words anymore. I use the word imitation. I am becoming more politically correct in my older, my aged years, and whether so imitation. I really go into a lot more detail because it is so complicated to try to show the novice who doesn't know anything about ancient coins and to keep them interested, which we did in Denver. There was nobody in there that was an ancient coin collector or an ancient coin dealer. Everyone there had never probably even seen an ancient coin or much less held one. But everyone there had a good time learning about them. And they went away, leaving, and they went home thinking, who stole the lamp and passed the hat? When I leave little one-liners in there, it gives them something to think about because then the whole thing comes back to their memory. So that's one thing I try to do in my presentations is leave a little something in there that's easy that can the person, the novice, or the person viewing can recall. Now, in the videos I'm doing now, I'm challenging coin dealers and ancient coin collectors on the highest scale. On the highest scale. I'm really putting an incredible presentation together, and I am putting the challenge out there for the planet that will just let them all know that, hey, you guys may be on a mountain, but my ridge is higher than yours because I have studied, I have done my homework, And I'm putting challenges out there. They can come at me. They can throw stones. And if any one of them can prove me wrong, so be it. Let's see it. Let's see it. And I've done that with a couple of my other videos, too. Hey, here it is. It proved me. Try to prove me wrong. And nobody has so far. Nobody. So, and there's going to be some good challenges in here for our ancient coin collectors and ancient coin dealers.
Oh, indeed. Well,
the world over, not just here, and right there where you're at in New York City, there's a few, and in New Jersey and around the surrounding area, there are some heavyweight ancient coin dealers, no doubt.
Well, as we move into the Dead Sea Scrolls, I'm interested in this work that you and Paul did, and my question. Harry, is can you tell listeners what material you had collected regarding the Dead Sea Scrolls?
Yes, I can. I can start by saying my father had two decades of Biblical Archaeology Review magazine.
Mm-hmm.
That magazine is based entirely on the Dead Sea Scrolls. And, I haven't seen one in years. But through the 90s and the 80s, everything about the magazine was based on the mystery and the fact that none of the Dead Sea Scrolls were released here. You couldn't just go to the store and buy, you know, a book that had all the Dead Sea Scrolls and the scripting and stuff. So I contacted people out of that magazine and through other books all across the planet. I obtained expensive Dead Sea Scrolls material from Russia, Czechoslovakia, Yugoslavia, and Poland. Now, I don't read Polish. I don't think Paul does either. But Paul reads Russian, and he reads he can read and speak and write Slavic. And neither one of us know Czech. Okay, so it didn't matter though who printed the book or the booklet. What mattered was the Hebrew, the block Hebrew script that was in the book that they were talking. That's what we knew. We both knew Hebrew script. Okay, so it didn't matter. And those books cost a lot of money, a lot of money. And the shipping was outrageous. And I had probably, as I'm looking at it, about 9 inches of, I call it book feet, 9 inches of book. Of the Dead Sea Scrolls, these little books that were like maybe 6 inches by 8 inches that are like roll, maybe 3/8 to a quarter of an inch to 3/8 thick, all black and white, no color, and all printed in these foreign countries. You could not buy, and I don't think you can still buy, the Dead Sea Scrolls here in America. Now, you've got all these guys on TV that say they have the Dead Sea Scrolls code and that they put them all together from piecing the letters together and this and that, which is all just a bunch of bunk. There's no Dead Sea Scrolls code. They scrambled it. They made it as difficult to obtain for scholars and everyone else. But even back in the 50s, there were some good Dead Sea Scrolls books printed. And then from there, a little snippet, Herschel Shanks, Dr. Herschel Shanks and his magazine, Biblical Archaeology Review, would just give all kinds of teases. Every magazine, every issue was nothing but teasing, just throwing the fly into the water, waiting for the fish to try to bite it and yanking it. That's all they did. That's all they did. And so the information on the Dead Sea Scrolls here in America is still today hard to come by.
So this was really interesting because of your friendship with Paul and his skill in translating some of the ancient script. Harry, initially, what work did you do before this presentation to translate the Dead Sea Scrolls?
Well, I'd worked real hard on them. I'd obtained information and from, like I said, from all over the world, what I could find. And I translated several of books that, not biblical books. I wanted to see The Sons of Light and The Sons of Darkness, for instance. I retranslated that from the Hebrew myself. And then after I met Paul, and I did other ones too, the Copper Scroll, I believe, and probably five or six more books. And then when I met Paul, and then we started looking more at the Hebrew block script, it didn't dawn on me. Paul came into the room and turns the light on, okay? He turns the light on, and then I really saw, and then I could explain to him, and because he was so familiar with the Semitic scripts, Syrian, Arabic, Aramaic, and he was far more familiar with those scripts, where I was only familiar with some Aramaic root stems and Hebrew, because I had all these Hebrew grammar books, Hebrew syntax, and this and that. Mm-hmm. Well, funny thing, the Dead Sea Scrolls, the block Hebrew, didn't even exist 2,000 years ago. And the Dead Sea Scrolls were written with a Latin syntax. It's not Semitic. It's not even a Semitic syntax. The syntax in the Dead Sea Scrolls doesn't match anything from ancient Aramaic, ancient Syrian, ancient Egyptian, Akkad, Ugarit. It doesn't match anything from back then. It flows. It flows like Latin. Even Egyptian hieroglyph was a Semitic language. So now we're talking about a Semitic language that predates what, 3000 BC. The word Semitic is a misnomer. It is a misrepresentation of a certain group of people and a certain language that didn't even exist at the time that the language. There's nothing in the Dead Sea Scrolls that resembles Phoenician syntax or Egyptian syntax.
Okay. I thought this was a real interesting area in this presentation. It was for people who are interested in languages, it's great because you're talking about Old Testament Hebrew, which has a nice structured grammar with tenses and declensions. And then you're looking at the biblical Hebrew with the former structure based on Latin grammar, which the Dead Sea Scrolls appear to be written in.
Well, they're also written on vermilion, which is goat skin. And goat skin wouldn't have even been used to 2,000 years ago. It wasn't up until after the invasions of the Islam, the Dark Ages. The Golden Age of Islam is actually, by our history, called the Dark Ages. So you have to delineate that. And they didn't even write on sheepskin or goat skin.
It's said in one reference online that 85% of the Dead Sea Scrolls were written on sheepskin. And
yeah.
So that's another indicator of a problem with referencing the date. So you have the grammar, the syntax of the particular language, the block Hebrew, and the grammar, and then you have the fact that it's on animal skin, which back then they wrote on papyrus.
Right. And then I had befriended a famous gospel preacher, and he had known that I was working on the Dead Sea Scrolls. He had known that, and this was even before I had met Paul, and that I had translated some of the books that with the information that I had. And he had contacted me and told me that he was going to be able to interview Dr. John Strugnell. And this was in the mid-90s. This was in the mid-90s. And he told me, he said, if you have any questions for Dr. John Strugnell, he said, give me some material. Give me some good, hard questions for him, because we'll get him out, because Strugnell was involved with a lot of controversy concerning the Dead Sea Scrolls. He turned into an alcoholic, and he died an early death, and he was a handwriting specialist, okay? He learned Hebrew after his skill. Hebrew was his secondary skill. Mm. Ancient languages were his secondary. His primary skill was handwriting analysis.
This is Dr. John Strugnell.
Yes. Mm-hmm. You know, and even in Biblical Archaeology Review, I remember seeing one of Dr. Shanks's BARs that when he came to Dr. John Strugnell, brilliant, 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 one of the smartest men in the world, but everything he says is wrong. What they said. So anyway, the preacher getting off the tangent, getting back to the main. Crux is the preacher told us, he said, I'm not going to mention his name. He passed away in 2010. And I'm like, okay. And I told Paul, I said, Paul, you know, this pastor, he's going to be interviewing Strugnell, and he wants some questions from me and you and to ask him. And I thought to myself, you know what? That would show just how slack I am. I said, look at all this information I've got on the Dead Sea Scrolls. If I can't come up with the answers, with all this data, I had at that time probably, oh gosh, between the BAR and all my books, maybe almost 3 book feet of Dead Sea Scrolls material. 3 book feet. Do you understand what I'm talking about? 3 book feet.
Oh, feet of books, okay.
Yeah, a book foot. People that have just tons and tons of books like me, I judge them all like book feet. And so I had like almost 3 book feet of Dead Sea Scrolls material, and I started hitting it. I started hitting it hard. And then my question was to Strugnell was, how come the writing looks similar? And even before he did the interview, he came out and said they were all written by the same hand. Now, that was big. That was big. Now, let's go back a little bit. Mm-hmm. We have this bogus, alleged historian, Roman historian, which I have called bogus on, named Flavius Josephus. Okay, I've busted that wide open. Mm-hmm. I did that 20 years ago, 25 years ago. That Josephus was bogus. And they say, well, it's Josephus that talks about the Essenes. The Essenes wrote the Dead Sea Scrolls. Well, you have to take the plural out of it. It was the Essene. The same person, the same handwriting, wrote all of the Dead Sea Scrolls that we have. And they're not going to come out and tell you that. They're not going to come out and tell you that. But even before the interview, Strugnell had already passed that on to the pastor. And he goes, hey, well, who are these guys? So Dr. John Strugnell, he knew about me and Paul before he died, because before he passed away before the interview was took place.
Oh, that's a shame.
Oh, yeah. And so he knew us. So it was nice for us to know that one of the guys that had been studying the Dead Sea Scrolls for 50-plus years knew us and knew about our research concerning the Dead Sea Scrolls. Now, on the video that we're talking about is on the Harry Hubbard YouTube channel. It's called The Dead Sea Scrolls Mystery. Mm-hmm. Who stole the lamp? Passed the hat. So we've reversed it. We put the Dead Sea Scrolls Mystery in the first part, and Who Stole the Lamp and Passed the Hat as the second title, but they're actually reversed in the actual video. Now, since we came out and called total bogus hoax on the Dead Sea Scrolls, that video did not go online until 2011, and we did it in summer of 1997. Other scholars, other people the world over have figured it out. And all you got to do is Google Dead Sea Scroll hoax, and it all comes up. Our video doesn't come up, I don't believe, but you will see that other people have come up with the same conclusions, but we were first. We did it in 1997, but the person that beat us to it was Dr. John Strugnow. He was the one that discovered, and he didn't come out and say it. See, that's the thing. He didn't come out and say it and publish it and print it, but the Dead Sea Scrolls were all bogus.
I guess he was hired to work on the scrolls maybe about three decades or so, and then he was banished from that work, and I guess his reputation was also in question.
He was Episcopalian. He's from England. Mm-hmm. We publicly called bogus hoax on the Dead Sea Scrolls in summer of 1997, and no one has challenged us. Because they can't. They can't. They don't know these languages. They don't know Egyptian syntax. They don't know Phoenician syntax. They don't know Aramaic syntax. They don't even know Latin syntax. And they're making a lot of money by teasing people that, hey, maybe one day we'll get to see what these Dead Sea Scrolls are. Well, all they got to do is bust their tail and spend hundreds and hundreds of dollars for the material from Czechoslovakia and Poland. But they don't have the brains to do that, or the know-how. They don't. They just don't know.
Well, once again, this is consistent with some of the other things that you uncovered in this particular presentation. I want to play a clip from Paul's presentation. Let's hear a clip of Paul coming to these conclusions that we're talking about in the actual video that we're speaking of, but we're going to listen to just a little bit of the audio.
Scholars, hang on to your seat.
Okay, this segment here, I'm going to be introducing to you the flow of ancient languages and ancient scripts and how they relate to history. And some very recent research I've done, I've exposed one of the greatest historical hoaxes. And this is the first time that I'm announcing it. When I met Meharry, he had a lot of great books on ancient languages and ancient scripts. I got interested in some that were dealing with Hebrew and Aramaic inscriptions. There was always like, okay, ancient Hebrew inscriptions. I'd look into books, and it was always an ancient Hebrew block script. But a suspicion I always had is like, where is the actual manuscript? I want to see the manuscript. It was always this typed Hebrew block script. I wanted to see the manuscript. Put it aside. Well, Harry had an excellent collection on the Dead Sea Scrolls, which I enjoyed studying. He has the best collection that anybody has information on the Dead Sea Scrolls. Every book and a lot of pirated information out of Poland that you can only get at a very high price on the Dead Sea Scrolls. He introduced it to me 2 years ago, but I was busy with other projects, and I said, well, I'm going to put it aside for now. When we actually started getting suspicious of these ancient coins, for me, it was actually due to something that happened to me back in 1988. I was up in Maine cutting wood and taking out a huge stump up at my uncle's cabin up in Harmony, Maine, 45 minutes north of Skowhegan, central Maine. And as we were pulling out the stump, there was a clump of dirt. It was almost 6 feet underground. This was a huge stump. There was this little clump of dirt, and I noticed something shining. I pulled it up. It took a while to clean it up completely. We put it through different solutions, and it cleaned up fairly well. In that clump was this coin here. Harry will bring it back tomorrow, which you can see at our table, the actual coin. But this is, we don't leave it out. This is actually a printed copy of the coin, forward with a head and a reverse. To me, it looked like it could be an ancient coin. It obviously was ancient. It was 6 feet under, it was dirty, and it was eroded in certain spots. But it was an ancient coin. But what bothered me was the script on it was very strange. It was a very strange script on it. And the first thing I decided to do was, okay, Harry, let's get some ancient coin books. That's before we figured out anything about ancient coin. Let's get some ancient Roman, Greek coins, anywhere that's available, and let's find this coin here. We had no luck. I took it to university professors. Can you identify this? No, I don't know what it is. They just theorized and had no clue. Never seen anything like that. Then when we went to this coin convention in Orlando, we decided, well, maybe there's some ancient coin expert there that can tell me what in the world this coin is. We took it to some people they don't know. Then we went to this expert, Dr. Saslow, who had these beautiful golden Alexander the Head coins for $10,000. And what really made me suspicious is when I walked up to a Ptolemy coin, and the funny thing was, on that coin, the word Ptolemy was written in Greek letters, but it was written like in English, Ptolemy, with the I at the end. In Greek, it was Ptolemaeus. And I looked at it and said, this is written in English with Greek letters. And he was charging $15,000 for that gold coin. And we just said, boy, oh boy, that's when we realized that a lot of this was faking. And we just happened to show this coin, and he looked at it and threw it back like that. Oh, it's fake. It's a fantasy coin. Okay, excuse me, Dr. Saslow. What is there about this coin here that is fake? Well, it's just a fantasy coin. You can make this, you get this out of a cereal box. Okay? With him and with others, we said, okay, please, you know that this is a fantasy coin. Would you please show us a fantasy coin? Just bring up a fantasy coin. Well, they made them all the time. I mean, these people made fantasy coins everywhere. They're just all over the place. Okay, could you please show us one? Nobody. Got very hostile over this coin, and I could not believe it. Why is somebody getting so emotional or hostile over a coin? Why didn't you just say, I don't know? It had a very strange inscription on it. Like you see right here, very, very strange inscription. And I started looking at that. I just started, okay, I can read ancient Greek, I can read Latin, and I know the Hebrew block script. But what I need to do is, I need to study the origin of the alphabets to solve this mystery here. So I started to get a collection of many books, and Harry had some, of actual ancient inscriptions, letters that were written on papyri in Egyptian, in Aramaic, from anywhere from 2000 BC up to like 500 to the time of Christ. I wanted to see actual ancient documents in their writing. And had a lot of success. This is a book here called Syrian Semitic Inscriptions, Volume 2. I'll tell you something about Volume 1, which is very peculiar. It has a bunch of letters written in Semitic Aramaic from time before Christ. All had the Phoenician Aramaic inscription in cursive and a regular Phoenician script. As you see here. Now I was starting to see some similarities between this and coin because this is some very old stuff that was found and that's authentic. And then I said, well, this is ancient Phoenician. It was a Semitic language, very akin to Hebrew. Except that the biblical Hebrew had a very structured and formal grammar, which was based on the Latin grammar. There was a Greek grammar in ancient times, there was Latin grammar. And I noticed something about Old Testament Hebrew. It had a very nice structured grammar. It had tenses, it had declensions, and everything. I mean, just a perfect, perfect grammar. And when I looked at these ancient Semitic inscriptions, they didn't have a perfect grammar. They were more like agglutinative root words where you can understand a very basic that everybody wrote. And this is the pattern I was seeing on these ancient Semitic inscriptions. I said, fine, we still haven't found the answer to this coin. So I started studying more ancient inscriptions from Italy. And then when we came up with this tomb, I was able, with the artifacts from the cave here in North America, looked at the inscription and said, boy, this is something unusual. It's not something you see all the time. The only word where I've seen similar inscriptions to this and to inscriptions that were found in Burroughs Cave, Illinois, were in southern Spain and northern Africa. And I wanted to get some books on them. They were called Iberic inscriptions. They had the strange Phoenician-type alphabet. But the funny thing is, no scholar studied them. This is one thing you will never see in any school. They're kind of locked up in museums in Spain and Portugal. They're on display. Nobody knows what they say. Nobody has tried to translate them. They've had problems. They couldn't decipher them and all that. And when I deciphered the inscriptions from the cave, I found that they had an Indo-Germanic root very akin to Latin and Old Italic, very basic root, noun, verb, subject, action, very simple writing. They wrote in different directions. Boustrophedon, which is where you start from left to right, and then the next line you go from right to left. There were direction writing up, down, up. Some of them written purely retrograde. All kinds of styles of writing. And it was a very, very basic form of communication. They wrote as they spoke. And you see the same thing when you read Egyptian hieroglyphs. The syntax is very different from modern languages. You have the entire hieroglyph, and it may say a sentence like, I'm saying an adoring prayer to Ra, you would say in English. In Egyptian, word order would be Ra, the great, adoring, I, prayer, say. Strange word order with Egyptian syntax. But then you have to actually work. When you read the old language and decipher it, you actually have to work very hard in getting the meaning into correct English. That's the hardest part. Now, what Dr. Wallace Budge does in his book, some of you may have seen the Book of the Dead and all that, it's really nicely written. He has the hieroglyph, and on the bottom of it, he writes the English translation. But you basically have to translate it in correct English yourself. Today, you have new versions of Book of the Dead where they were just added a whole bunch of new things in there. And if you want to read the Book of the Dead, get Wallace Budge's Book of the Dead. That is the best and accurate translation. But this is one thing I noticed about all these ancient languages and these tablets that I deciphered. They had a very simple grammar, very simple syntax, and were relatively easy to read. You can make a free translation. Lots of abbreviations. When I studied Old Testament Hebrew and New Testament Greek, New Testament Greek is in fine grammar. It goes back to about 200 AD. You can see in the Coptic and all that, the New Testament, the Greek was such a refined grammar. It's pretty much case closed how it is. That existed. Old Testament Hebrew, I noticed, for one thing, it was written in this very perfectly structured grammar of Semitic language. And I kept on reading ancient Hebrew inscriptions. When I looked at ancient Hebrew, now volume 1 has a lot of pictures with ancient Hebrew. Now here this Assyrian Semitic inscriptions. They call this one ancient Hebrew. I looked at it. It's in the old Phoenician alphabet. As a Semitic scholar myself, I cannot tell the difference between Hebrew and Aramaic. The vocabulary is identical, except there are a few words in a dialect that are slightly different. The script is in the ancient Phoenician script. The language is in Semitic. How can somebody claim that this is Hebrew and this is Aramaic? I didn't know. Then I started studying the Old Testament a little more, and I noticed everything was in block Hebrew, neat script. I got very curious. I said, well, what is the oldest copy of the Old Testament there is? I want to know old scrolls of the Old Testament or something that I can look at. Well, as Harry and I do, we find the answers in Encyclopedia Judaica. Great set. If you ever want to know anything about ancient history or what's happening, or contemporary people, look at Encyclopedia Judaica. Most libraries have. You'll find a lot of information there. We looked at Encyclopedia Judaica, ancient Hebrew inscriptions, especially the Bible, because we studied the Bible a lot, too. Well, surprisingly, there were none. The earliest Old Testament inscription in Hebrew script comes from about 800 AD, and then it turned into the Masoretic texts. And I asked myself, where did it come from? looked at the oldest manuscripts in this nice, beautiful block Hebrew script. Nice grammar, everything. And one thing I noticed about the Old Testament Hebrew and the block script and the grammar, that it is very much in Latin syntax. The Semitic language, which was very raw in Phoenician times, was taken, and with the help of the Greek grammar and the Latin grammar, it was structured. And all of a sudden, you see the appearance of the Hebrew block script with this beautifully structured grammar pop up in the Middle Ages about 750 to 800 AD. It's just everywhere. Just pops up out of nowhere, everywhere. Then I decided to do a little more research because I wasn't quite getting the picture. I said, well, let's look at some more ancient inscriptions, and I was coming back to these ancient alphabets that you find on stones and on papyri. That is a clue. In ancient times, around the time of Christ or before, any time something was handwritten, they used the papyrus to write on. That was a very important thing that I ended up noticing. Papyrus and stone were the two main forms of communication. But another peculiar thing I noticed is when doing research, I decided to study the archaeology of the Middle East. Because one time I watched a television show when I was 14, and there was an old German archaeologist, I don't know if it was Maria Reike, who worked in Peru, but she also went to Israel and Egypt, and she made a statement. She said, and that really got me to second, she said there was absolutely no archaeological evidence that the Exodus ever happened, that David, Solomon, and Saul, and all these great Israelite kings ever existed. I kept that in my background. No archaeological evidence at all. So I decided, okay, let's do some more research. So I was studying the Bible and everything. And then we decided, when Harry decided to get the entire ancient history collection for our tomb research and all this, we decided to read ancient historians. Let's find out if anything correlates. Well, there are a few sources that talk about the Hebrews. One source is the ancient Egyptian priest Manetho. And there's many other classical sources, but I really like Manetho because there was a stone from this cave in Illinois that I deciphered. There was a figure on the front that appeared to look like Moses. In the back of it, it gave a name. It was Ozarzef.
That was Paul Shafranke speaking at a 1997 presentation titled The Dead Sea Scroll Mystery, Who Stole the Lamp? Pass the Hat. And Paul is talking about how to validate the authenticity of the Dead Sea Scrolls script by grammar and syntax. And consistently, these are the topics that you and Paul look at, such as cartography, ancient maps, the misdirection and manipulation of that critical information, the origin of Thanksgiving, the covert works of the Knights Templar in concealing themselves through the centuries, and the ancient artifact and coin racket. Harry, I want to say thank you for being on the show. This is, once again, remarkable work.
My pleasure, Jeff. Let's do it again.
Indeed, we will. That's going to do it for In Other News. I'm Jeff Brady. Visit inothernewsradio.com for more information and archive shows.